Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Mustful, your host today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Kent Graham, author of the book Gettysburg, The Living and the Dead. Kent, thank you for joining me today.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Kent Graham is an adjunct professor of English and Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. A Wisconsin native, Graham has also taught at colleges in Germany, Illinois, and Indiana. He holds a PhD in creative writing and American literature from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and studied theology at Princeton Theological Seminary at the University of Tübingen, Germany. He has written books, plays, novels, and poetry about Abraham Lincoln, Gettysburg, and the American Civil War. His book, November, Lincoln's Elegy at Gettysburg, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and the graduate writing program at LSU awards an annual Kent Graham Prize in creative nonfiction. Finally, he is a lifelong student of the Civil War. And Kent, that's where I'd like to begin. Could you tell us more about your interest in Abraham Lincoln and Gettysburg and the American Civil War?
I can try. It's one of those questions that is very natural, but almost impossible to answer. Why does a person become interested in something at an early age? Which I did. I suppose I was about 10 or 11 and I got interested in the Civil War. I had a couple of friends at the time, Bruce and Mike, who were interested in the war. And I guess we fostered each other's interests. I had a wonderful teacher, Yvonne, who encouraged us. And I think these things are important to have someone else share your interest, and at an early age to have a teacher who encourages rather than shuts you down.
Sure.
But why one becomes interested in one thing specifically rather than another is a mystery. I think that's one of the mysteries of life. I mean, I was exposed to railroads and trains, but I didn't become a train guy. You know, I liked horses at that age, but I'm not a horse person. That one interest caught hold, and I can't really tell you why, but an interest like that tends to develop and change, and one hopes mature as time goes on. You know, at first you're interested in uniforms and soldiers, and some kids are interested in the guns and cannons and stuff like that. At a certain point, you start to integrate that with the questions that life poses to you as you get into your teen years and into your 20s. You know, you start to think that life is unjust, that life is tragic, life can be cruel, it can be glorious. And how do you get a handle on that? And one of the ways you do that is through a strong interest that you've had since childhood. In this case, it's a war. I mean, I'm not really a war guy, but I'm interested in how people act under extreme pressure. This is why Shakespeare and the Greek writers and so on wrote about people in power, people in love, people at war. It's because it's a way of trying to get a handle on that great question that Elie Wiesel says has no answers, the question why. This is a rather long answer. You asked me why, you know, how I got interested.
Sure. Did you grow up in Pennsylvania or around Gettysburg?
No, I didn't come to Gettysburg until I was, I think, 20 or 21.
Okay. And what was that like the first time you visited the battlefield?
Well, it was strange. It was almost like a sense of recognition. And as some people say who visit Gettysburg, there's something about the place that gets you. And indeed, that's what happened. And so I started coming back yearly and then more than yearly and started spending a lot of time here and finally was able to move here. I mean, not exactly to Gettysburg, but pretty close.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose they begin to recognize you as a regular, huh?
I think so. I've been recognized on the battlefield a few times. It's always a little disconcerting.
Well, let's get into the book then, Gettysburg, The Living and the Dead. It's such a unique book, I'm not sure how to classify it. I wonder if you could try to describe in your own words how you would classify the narrative and the genre here.
I agree with you that it can't be classified, or at least I don't know how to do so, and I'm not sure that there are books that are very similar in terms of the genre. It's a mixture of genres. And maybe that's the thing that most characterizes it. Half of it is photographs, these beautiful photographs by Chris Heisey. And we matched them with texts that I wrote. And the texts themselves are a number of genres, all of them, in a sense. You know, if you count the four major genres as fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and drama, there's some of all of them in these texts. So the literary text mix the genres, and then there's the visual along with the written genre. So it's either a real mess or it's an integration that matches more our real experience. Mm-hmm. When we go to a battlefield like Gettysburg, we aren't just affected by one stream of perceptions, you know, our memories of what we've read about the battle or words that come back like the Gettysburg Address. These are matched with visuals. We're there on the battlefield and we see these things and we can touch these monuments and we can walk the fields. And so it seems to me that the more you can get in terms of the genres, the more like real experience it is. And that's kind of what the point is, in a way, of the book, is to try to get to that real experience.
Well, I think it definitely evokes a lot of emotion, and it's very thought-provoking. And I can see a lot of creative writing skills put to use to really manipulate an emotional response in the book.
Well, thank you. That's good. But I must say that I didn't really try to manipulate anyone. I guess what you do is simply try to be true to the experience or the perception that you happen to have. And for me, there was a great deal of emotional involvement, and that comes through, I think, naturally.
In the prologue, you have a staged photograph of a fallen soldier, and I'm interested in how you refer to it as art. How do you use art to really convey the depths of the human experience at Gettysburg?
It seems to me that art is the closest we can come to conveying experience, because The straightforward recording, you know, collecting and recording of facts, insofar as we can determine what they are, which is crucial. We have to do that. That's sort of the foundation for all this. But they do not really contain the experience and the emotion. That is for art to do, because so much of the experience actually is emotional and possibly spiritual. And so you need something that selects and arranges impressions and bits and pieces of history or the present, and presents them in such a way that these emotions are reproduced or perhaps evoked. And you asked specifically about that first photograph in the prologue. That's the only photograph in the book that's a historical photograph that Chris Heise didn't shoot. Mm-hmm. It's a well-known picture of a sniper at Devil's Den. And when you visit the battlefield and you go to the Confederate side, you know, Devil's Den, and you see those rocks that were piled up there, and you see the photograph that the Park Service has put there. There's controversy over that photograph. It hasn't really been, at least to my knowledge, clearly established exactly what the circumstances of that photograph were. I think the general consensus now is that the photographers who were there several days after the battle first photographed the body several or more than several yards from those rocks, and then dragged the body behind that wall. Mm-hmm. But I've read a very persuasive article saying, no, it was just the other way around, that he was first photographed there because the gunners, that is the cannoneers on Little Round Top, who were being shot to death by these long-distance sharpshooters, had to have some way of trying to get at them, even though they were behind these rocks, and in this case, behind rocks that were piled up. So they cut their fuses. You talk about art. Artillery was an art during the Civil War. It wasn't only a science. You had to allow for the wind. You had to allow for the recoil of your guns. That is, you couldn't, you know, resight in the same place. And most of all, you had to cut your fuses exactly right. And so these really experienced Union gunners try to cut their fuse so that the shell would explode right over the heads, the heads of these snipers. And you died not from shrapnel, but from the concussion. The shell exploding right over you is a terrific impact. And it is possible either to imagine or to actually see blood coming out of this poor soldier's ears and nose and mouth. And so if that's accurate, then possibly he was killed by concussion. And this was where he was. Again, I'm probably telling you a lot more than you wanted to know.
But that's quite interesting.
The point is that one way or another, the original photographers who were recording the actual scenes there did employ some kind of art, because one way or another, they moved the body at least a little bit, even if this young man was his body was actually there. They still moved it a little. They probably faced him a little more toward the camera. They certainly put the rifle. It's not a sharpshooter's musket, but a regular rifle, leaned it against the rocks. And the idea there was to convey something. You see this again and again with these really artful photographers right after these battles. A classic example is the one at the Dunker Church at Antietam, where the person put a pair of shoes in front of the scene of the dead horse and the bodies lying there in front of Dunker Church. And the idea of those shoes, just like we find at the Holocaust Museum today in Washington, D.C., that really conveys a sense of personhood. You know, there's an actual person here and not just a gory feature. So I sort of attributed to the photographer fictionally, you know, the possibility that what he's trying to convey is the sadness, the tragedy, in this case, not the causes, but just the tragedy of death. And that tragedy is literally brought home because you see this person lying there who was, in the words of a popular Civil War song, somebody's darling. Mm-hmm. And that's what the photograph is of, I think.
Well, that's certainly quite interesting how much you can take away from one photograph like that, as far as speculation as how he died and where he died, and then certainly then the tragedy behind it and the personhood, as you mentioned. I'd like to talk a little bit more about personhood because there are numerous voices throughout this book of different people and perspectives involved in Gettysburg, and you really did a great job of capturing those voices. So talk a little bit about who is in this book. Who are you representing?
All right. I'll try. There are two kinds of voices. One is voices of the dead, those who were present at the battle, active in the battle, or witnesses at the time of the battle or shortly thereafter, and then the living, those who might be alive today or those who visited the battlefield and who are in some way or another affected. That phrase, the living and the dead, is indirectly from the Gettysburg Address. So maybe the place to start in terms of personality is with Abraham Lincoln. And with Lincoln, you have, I think, a mystery again. I have used the word just a few minutes ago, and this probably won't be the last time in this hour that I will, but there's so much there that is mysterious, that is beyond comprehension, and that's the almost endless attraction of something like this, something as terrible as a battle. And when you go there, you see this beautiful battlefield. The combination of those two is the first mystery that you encounter at Gettysburg. How can something so awful, hell on earth, look so heavenly, so beautiful, nearly at all times of the year? And even more so before they did all the tree cutting on the battlefield. But it's still beautiful. So how can this be? That is a presentation of life itself in a larger sense. We live in a beautiful world that we are rapidly trashing and possibly even destroying ourselves along with it. How does that beauty match the human activity that we see, the way we are toward each other, which is sometimes noble and gracious, and other times just so savage and selfish? Well, this is present in small form, relatively small form, on a battlefield like Gettysburg. What reminds you of it is the display of statuary on the field. It's the largest display of statuary out in the open in the world. I don't remember how many figures there are, but there are a great many. And that reminds you of what goes on. So on that battlefield, you have this overlay of human history. And that gets toward that mystery, Lincoln being at the center of it, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, who was this person? Did anybody really know him? Even those who were close to him admitted there was a certain kind of mystery. And I think that's typical of us, too. We are in some ways mysteries to ourselves. At any rate, so you have Lincoln. And I took a witness. There's an account written by a boy who was 14 at the time. He was a boy from Chambersburg, which is about 30 miles west of Gettysburg. The Army of Northern Virginia came through Chambersburg on its way to Gettysburg. He witnessed that. And then he went and he saw Abraham Lincoln. And I believe he did actually get to be right up front, right under the president as he spoke. Did he actually figure out who Lincoln was? No, but I just took that little historical fact and what I remembered from his book and tried to be there with him, tried to hear him as he remembered being there in front of Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And then four of the women who knew Abraham Lincoln, trying to sort of get at some aspect of him, his sister, Sarah, and Anne Rutledge, and the two mothers he had, his birth mother, and Nancy Hanks Lincoln, and his mother after that, Sarah Bush Lincoln, whom he credited with everything he was. He said he owed to her. I think he owed to all of them, and they all are ways of trying to look at aspects of him. At any rate, there we have a long start with the person, in a sense, at the center of the battle and its meaning. Now, you asked about other figures. Well, things that come to mind. Colonel Cross, an actual historical figure, a real fire-eating great colonel who entered the battle with his men, knowing that he was going to be killed. This happens in the Civil War in memorable ways. Soldiers saying, I know I'm not going to get through this. I'm not going to come out of this. Would you please send this to my family afterwards? I mean, we don't know how many guys were wrong about that, but we know that a lot of them were right. And Colonel Cross, he was bald, and he always wore a red kerchief around his head going into battle. This time he asked his orderly for a black one, and he said that he wasn't going to come back. He wasn't going to come out of it. At any rate, that's a figure that goes into battle and is really exhorting his men. He's full of the fire of battle. And one thing that I think must be understood, especially among those of us who study a war that took place 160 years ago, that it wasn't as neat as it looked in the books, as neat and clean and almost pleasant. Homer got it right at the beginning of the Iliad. It's about rage. It's about this fierce rage and anger. And so Colonel Cross goes into battle just with the terrific rage of battle. And all I have to do with him and with all of the figures that I wrote prose about, it's a little different from the several poems that are in there, but prose, all I have to do is listen. And, that's what I heard Colonel Cross saying. There are some others at the time, not only soldiers. I've got quite a few soldiers in here, both Southerners and Northerners. And I tried to convey some of their motivation, some of the causes, because they died for these causes. It was important what they believed about secession or slavery one way or the other. But then there's some witnesses. There's a young mother with children. This is based on something that was actually reported in the first hours of the battle west of town. Someone saw a young mother with a couple or three children trying to get away. And there were, kind of an untold story is that there were a lot of black folk on the Confederate side, not fighting on the Confederate side, but doing a lot of the work. And so I have one or two of these people speaking. So I tried in that way to convey or to get at or to, well, basically just to listen to some of them, what they said. Several of the people who were killed were women dressed up as men in uniform and probably were not recognized as women at the time. This was an earlier day and age, and you could get in battle and go through campaigns without, having to reveal your gender. This happened. Several of the bodies that were found by burial parties after the battle on the Confederate side were women. So one of these people who speaks is a woman who's there basically to take care of her brother who enlisted, anyway. So there's a kind of a variety of people who were there at the time with various motivations. And one or two of them dying in hospitals afterwards. There's one mother who comes just a little too late to Camp Letterman, where her son has just died. So these are the contemporary figures, you know, at that time. Mm-hmm. And then the other half of the text are present day people. I should probably stop and let you ask more if you'd like, or do you want me to just continue to
go ahead and talk a little bit about those present day people. I think they play just as an important role as those historical figures.
I'm glad you think so. I think so too, and I think this is Lincoln's point in the Gettysburg Address. I mean, the point of that address is the future. It's us. Lincoln entrusts the meaning of the war, the results of the war, to the future. If you look at that speech, it contains three paragraphs, one very short one, another one a little bit longer, and then the long one, which is dedicated to the future. And that means you and me. That's us. So I think we are part of the battle in the sense of its significance and its meaning. So some of these people who are contemporary are based on facts and are people that I really met on the battlefield, or at least there's some element of what they say that is based on someone that I've known or who has said something like that or who has been there. Some of them are very close to facts, like the person from rural Virginia. He wasn't actually from Virginia, but a different southern state, who had come up because his son had recently been killed in Iraq, and he had never been out of his home state, and he was coming up to Gettysburg to try to understand something about his son, the soldier. And I spent a few hours with that person going around the battlefield. And then there's a musician. I took something he said, description of somebody I know, and a few others like that. And then there are a few who come onto the battlefield sort of from different places in either in my memory or in the past. And they're, of course, heavily fictionalized. But what I'm trying to do is get at something real, something true. Mm-hmm. As Emily Dickinson said, tell the truth, but tell it slant. It's like a frontal assault, you know, during the Civil War. It's very seldom successful in really trying to do what you want to do. But sometimes if you come at something obliquely, you can get at something. You know, we see these strange things in life sometimes out of the very corners of our eyes, and we're not sure we actually see them. So fiction or fictionalizing, or what you might call creative nonfiction, which a lot of the pieces are a way of trying to get at that. And I try to remove myself from the whole book and just listen to other people. But it's inevitable that some of these other people have things to say, whether I agree with them or not, about contemporary issues. There's a man who comes over from Germany in the 1920s, and he's employed by one of the apple producers in Adams County, and it's inevitable to think of immigrants today. I mean, you don't have to say it. All I did was have this young German's letter back home, and at the time, Germans were not thought very well of. This was between the wars. You didn't like the Germans after World War I if you were of German heritage. You sometimes tried to cover that up, or you didn't speak German. And then something even worse comes along, World War II. So this is not a happy day for Germans. And so a lot of people looked at these German immigrants in a very negative way, which is what we're experiencing now. But sometimes historical things have a lot to say about the present. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should look through the table of contents in order to come up with a few other things. First,
you quoted one of the narrators of the stories said, "History is personal, folks. History is today." Maybe you can elaborate a little on that.
That's a that's a fellow who's who's got a tour group, and he's looking at the Excelsior Brigade's monument and looking up toward the peach orchard, and he's talking about General Dan Sickles. And General Sickles was a politician, a very unsavory character, according to some, and unsavory reputation, who really was not qualified for his position. He was popular with his men, very popular. He seemed to have a lot of pluck. He'd not been to West Point. He just sometimes did not know what he was doing out there, but he was very sure of himself at the same time, Dan Sickles was. So he got promoted because of personal, even Abraham Lincoln liked him personally. He got these promotions, and he wound up commanding an entire Army Corps at Gettysburg. And he was, if he was even qualified to command a regiment, I mean, that would be controversial. At any rate, he was in command of an entire Army Corps that was assigned a portion of a line along the main cemetery ridge line. He had had a bad experience 6 weeks previous at the Battle of Chancellorsville with some Confederate artillery on higher ground, and he thought he was on low ground, so he moved forward to the peach orchard, which was somewhat higher ground, and thereby abandoning the highest ground in that portion of the battlefield, the Round Tops, Little Round Top and Round Top itself, and extending his line to twice the length that it could really defend. He almost lost the battle. He was an enormous liar. And he said afterwards that he saved the battle. I mean, maybe he believed it. He was certainly a narcissist and an egoist. He claimed that he saved the battle by moving his corps out and using up some of Longstreet's attack on the second day of the battle, which I think virtually every responsible historian that I've read completely disbelieves and discredits. And it's an insult to the Army of the Potomac. Because to assume that they couldn't have defended their Cemetery Ridge line as well the second day as they did the third day, I think is an insult. At any rate, so he moves his men out there, and General Meade, who commands the Army of the Potomac, has to advance parts of two other Army Corps piecemeal to try to shore up that line. That's a good way to get a lot of men killed, is to feed them in piecemeal, but Meade had no choice because of what Sickles had done. So this guy who's giving the tour is telling all that, or some of that, to the people who are listening to him, looking at this monument to the Excelsior Brigade, Sickles' original brigade. This guy says, you know, I had a relative who was in Sickles' Third Corps, and he was killed in that peach orchard. And there are a lot of second and third cousins that I don't have. There's a lot of family that I don't have because of that young man being killed through the errors, egoism, incapacity, incompetence, insubordination mm-hmm. of a general. And so that becomes personal. So he says that's personal. Now you are free to take whatever implications he would like to from that last statement of his, history is now. Henry David Thoreau said, it is the province of the historian to find out not what was, but what is. Mm-hmm.
Certainly the consequences reverberate all the way to today.
Yes.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the spiritual and religious aspects of this book. I'll read one quote here from the story Blood and Water. You write, "The Savior knew what they would do to him. He understood the agony and he was afraid, but for some purpose I will never understand, he went ahead." And that's something you seem to grapple with throughout the stories, is reconciling our own faith. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'll try to. These people who fought on both sides were people of strong and deeply held, most of them, religious faith. It was a different era in those days. And that religious faith, varied a lot. There were Catholics and Jews and Protestants of all stripes. The giants of American Protestantism at the time were the Baptists and the Methodists. These were people who had grown up with revivals, and so they had this background in their heads. And people like Abraham Lincoln might have had one or two books in their in their houses growing up, and one of those two, or that one, would be the King James translation of the Bible. And so they knew their Bibles very well. Lincoln knew it extremely well. It permeates his speeches. And he knew he was talking to people who resonated with that, because they knew those passages too, and they recognized those references. When he says in the Gettysburg Address, 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth. He knows that phrase, brought forth, is in the King James translation of the nativity narrative. Brought forth means is a way of saying to give birth to. And there's several other references there. He knew his people would understand that, because it was a common comprehension, a common, it was in the air that they breathed. In the Civil War, shattered a lot of that, or deepened a lot of that, changed people's faiths. And so to ascribe to these mid-19th century Americans a religious way of speaking and thinking about things, I think is accurate, and I don't think we understand them without it. It might be alien to many of us, but that was the atmosphere in which they moved. And so, yes, they're trying to make sense of their own experience. And here they are out in this battlefield, which is smoke, dust, noise, and worst of all, an apparent randomness of who was getting killed. The person next to you gets hit, that awful thunk of a mini ball, hitting the person next to you. You wonder, are you going to be next? What makes the difference? Is somebody calling the shots, or is it just complete randomness and nobody's in charge? Mm-hmm. So the battle presents that kind of chaos to people with religious upbringing. And maybe a way to see that in more modern terms, is to look at the writing of Elie Wiesel, who was a very devout and knowledgeable, studied young Jewish boy when he went into the concentration camps. And he came out with what he calls a wounded faith. He had to try to come to grips with this. How do you do that? And I think people in the Civil War were trying to do that. There's a great book on World War I by Paul Fussell called The Great War in Modern Memory, where he sees that war as being a watershed in how people conceived of progress, conceived of civilization, and conceived of their own beliefs. I think we went through that 50 years previous to that during the Civil War. And a lot of people came out really damaged. When you think about the Civil War, it was just a tremendous shock that we cannot really conceive of. If you look at the arithmetic, the numbers, consider 9/11. What effect that had on this country? What effect it continues to have that one day? Mm-hmm. Well, if you take the Civil War's casualties, and you transpose the numbers into today's population, it's 9/11 every day for 4 years in terms of the numbers. And in fact, it's a bit worse than the numbers of 9/11. Imagine the crushing impact that has on people. That's only the dead. Think of all, during the Civil War, the medical capabilities were not as great as we have now. So many, many more people remained disabled for life, having lost an arm or a leg, not just through the lack of knowledge of the surgeons or through their haste, but because of the weaponry. The soft lead mini ball just shattered bone. There wasn't much to reconstruct, and so there was a lot of just think of this, a million people in that country with its population hobbling around or disabled, and almost every family had somebody either in that family or somebody close in their extended family who was killed or disabled or made mentally incapable by their experience in that war. So you have to come to grip with something like that, and all you have are the tools that you were given when you were younger, namely the Christian faith or the Jewish faith. How do you reconcile those two? So that's why there's a lot of talk of religion in this book, because I think it's actually a faithful or an accurate way to try to get at their experience. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be relevant to us today, I think.
Well, I think so too. And you made a good point about making sense of their experience. And it goes all the way to today. And I get a sense of mourning throughout this book. I get a sense of healing too. Do you think we'll ever be healed from that division, from that grief and tragedy of the American Civil War?
This opens up quite a bit of talk, and I'm afraid I'm on the verge of yet another long answer.
Okay.
I think there are two ways to look at this. One is that the United States has been remarkable in getting over the Civil War the way other countries have not. There are countries that divided and fought within themselves, and hundreds of years later, they're still at each other's throats. And we don't seem to have that in this country. But it came at an enormous price. And the price was paid by Black folk, you know, that the price was that we re-narrated the Civil War, the most influential movie perhaps of all time. At least my son-in-law, who's a film history guy, says was Birth of a Nation. It's Woodrow Wilson's favorite movie. It's incredible, it's incredibly awful in terms of its blatant racism. That's how people thought in those days. And the idea was that the South had a real story to tell. And it comes through even better in Gone with the Wind 20 years later. A magnificent story and a magnificent movie, but full of visible and sometimes not so visible, or at least more subtle, kinds of racism as well as sexism. And so the country has had to grapple with that. And I think contemporary events show that we have not gotten over that. We haven't healed that essential element of the Civil War. And I think we haven't really fixed the relationship of federal and local or federal and state very well either. But the main thing, I think, is that re-narrating the Civil War, that the most recent generation, as I read them, of historians have been trying to fix. I mean, rehabilitating U.S. Grant, for example, because the narrative was that the Confederate generals were more skilled, better human beings, and so on. And a person like Grant was a butcher, a plotter. And I think the new books on Grant show him to be a thoughtful, imaginative, excellent general and person as well. So making the narrative, you know, it's the end of Reconstruction was a catastrophe for a certain portion of our population. It was a deal that was cut what Mark Twain called the Hayes-Tilden swindle, so that the Republicans could stay in office for another 4 years. And part of the deal was to end the occupation of the South. And you know, all these things were paid. There was a cost, you know, that was paid by somebody. And I think we're left with that legacy now. So I think that on the one hand, we have overcome the division of the Civil War quite a bit, but on the other hand, we are more divided again now. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War and its divisions then. It seems to me that our divisions now are deeper, possibly more dangerous, and they're not geographical, which makes them worse. And I think it's partly because we haven't really processed and worked through and healed the Civil War and the issues at the heart, the core of the Civil War.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, you talk about someone like Lincoln, and I think, you know, dozens of books are published about him every year from varying perspectives. And, you know, I think it's something that we're still trying to understand what happened and who he was in the center of all that. And of course, the question you brought up earlier is why?
Yeah.
Now let's talk about the photography. It's stunning. It's absolutely beautiful photography. Tell us about the photographer, Chris Heisey, and how you came to work with him.
Chris Heisey is a real artist. He's the real thing. He has been to Gettysburg, by his count, over the last, I forget whether he said 30 or 40 years, about 10,000 times.
Oh, my God.
And he lives fairly close. He lives only, you know, about a half an hour away. But he goes there, as you can see from these photographs, which I think you rightly called, I'm glad you called stunning. These photographs were taken at any time of the day or night. I mean, he'll go out on a winter night and take a long exposure of the night sky. There's one in here, you know, taking a devil's den and the star trails. And he'll sit out there, stand out there and freeze for several hours, you know, to get just the right thing. He'll go there during the worst possible weather for driving. You know, he scares me sometimes. Mm-hmm. He drives down there, you know, there's just ice all over, in order to shoot photographs, in order to get things at all seasons, at all times of day, to try to get that combination of nature and history, which he does so brilliantly, and he does so beautifully. It's like a great poem. It has to be not only thought-provoking, or it has to not only cue you to the whole tradition of literature, but it has to be beautiful. You have to like it. There has to be something about it that makes you want to read it. And that's I think, the case with all good art. And his photographs not only are thought-provoking, but they're beautiful. So he publishes and has for the last, 15 years or so, an annual calendar. He goes all over the country taking photographs at Civil War battlefields and writing little pieces about them in that month. So he is a really dedicated professional. He is a professional photographer. His day job, the job where you have to earn your living, but he uses those skills and develops them on these battlefields. And I should say that his passion, as you can see from many of the photographs, like spider webs or insects, his passion is nature photography. And we're working on something on along those lines now. But he could not create these stunning photographs unless he were emotionally affected and a real participant in that battlefield, in the spirit of the battlefield himself. I feel fortunate to work for him. You said how work with him. I haven't answered your question how we got in contact. About 15 years ago, I was in charge of an annual Civil War interdisciplinary weekend seminar seminary, held at the seminary, the Seminary Ridge Symposium. And he was at one of the early ones. And he came up to me afterwards and we started talking and we realized that he had all these photographs of the battlefield and I had written some poems about the battlefield. So that's when we put together our first book. This book now, I think, is much more substantial, much more ambitious. But it was started on that first project that we made about 15 years ago.
There's a very nice photograph of the two of you next to a cannon and the back jacket there.
Yeah. I wish there had been something a bit more peaceful than a cannon proposed in front of, but after all, it is a battlefield.
Yeah.
And you know what General Sherman said about war and battle, you know, there it is.
So you said you're working on something else right now with Chris Heisey?
Yeah, maybe it's a superstition, but I hate to talk too much about a project that's currently going because I tell my writing students don't talk away your project. But yeah, we're doing one now that involves longer, more texts and more photographs, and it's basically nature stuff. And he as stunning as these photographs are, Civil War photographs. I mean, I hope this book gets finished and actually finds a publisher because it'll be unusual too. But those the nature photographs just knock you out. They're just terrific, I think. Yeah, so that's basic sort of what we're doing.
Okay. Well, as I said, the photographs in here are stunning, and I just love the various angles he goes with and various perspectives, sometimes just showing a shadow of an object. And it's really beautiful the way he does that. So I can only imagine what his nature photographs look like.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Well, you know, I just want to commend you for what you have created here. And I think it really, each story is its own you know, they're all related to the first day of the battle, second day of the battle, third day of the battle. But each it has its own story within it, and it really elicits a lot of empathy. And I think you did a great job of representing those different voices and bringing them to life and really posing some important questions about how do we, you know, reconcile this experience and deal with this tragedy.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Where can readers find your book so they can buy it?
Well, it is on Amazon. The book's only been out about a month, so it's not, you know, it hasn't hit your local newsstand. Mm-hmm. And I was just down in Gettysburg a few days ago, and I did not find any copies there, even at the visitor center at the battlefield. It's published by Southern Illinois University Press. The easiest place that I know of right now is Amazon. I know it's available there. Can be ordered directly from the press, and I hope before long it'll be available locally for those listeners who might be in central Pennsylvania, northern Virginia, and so on.
Well, great. I would definitely encourage listeners to go out and get this book. I've been talking with Kent Graham, author of the book Gettysburg, The Living and the Dead. Kent, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.